Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Excerpts from an interview with Professor Fawaz Gerje from the London School of Economics. Israel has been attacking Lebanon, partly in retaliation for Hezbollah attacks since the war on Iran began. 1,000 Lebanese civilians have been killed and 1 million are displaced from their homes. Now Israel has escalated the bombing to include Beirut. Fawaz describes the Israeli action as collective punishment and explains that Hezbollah is not simply a paramilitary group, but a political and social movement as well. Also, he says that people fleeing war zones in the recent past have ended up immigrating to European countries where they are not welcome. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Beirut is under fire as Israeli warplanes continue to pound the Lebanese capital on Wednesday in a further escalation of the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran. Lebanese authorities say at least 12 people were killed when apartment buildings and several residential neighborhoods were struck. The attacks, which Israel says are aimed at the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah, are some of the most intense on the Lebanese capital in decades and have hit far from Hezbollah's stronghold in the city's southern suburbs. Let's bring in Fawaz Gerjes. He's a professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at London School of Economics. Fawaz, welcome back to DW. Now, Israel has been escalating its attacks on Lebanon. We saw they are displacing millions. Is this mission, from the Israeli perspective, going according to plan?
Well, we have just begun. Israel has just started this new round of war in the past 10 days or so. More than 1 million displaced Lebanese as a result of Israel's blanket evacuation orders. Almost 1,000 killed civilians, mostly. More than 100 children. More than 40 medical workers. Really, you can summarize Israel's strategy in two words: collective punishment. What Israel is trying to do is to basically punish the entire social base of Hezbollah, the Shiite population, in South Lebanon, in the Bekaa Valley, and in Dahia in Beirut. And basically, it does not really distinguish between military and civilian targets. In fact, the United Nations Human Rights Office made it very clear that Israel's evacuation orders and the mass displacement amounts to a war crime. Yet Israel does not really care. And finally, Israel has just launched what it called a targeted ground operation. And Israeli officials are preparing to call tens of thousands, in fact, hundreds of thousands of Israel's reserves in order, quote, unquote, according to Israeli officials, to implement the Gaza model in Lebanon. So this is very scary, very, very scary.
Absolutely. That's something I want to touch on a little later. Israel, of course, says this is an operation aimed solely at Hezbollah. How strong is the group at this point in time?
Well, Israel said the same thing about Hamas in Gaza in a 2-year war that has killed almost 70,000 Palestinians. This is, Israel says, Hezbollah, 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 Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. But yet the brunt of Israeli attacks are basically on civilian targets. That's distinguish between civilians and military target. Hezbollah's capabilities had been degraded a great deal in the first round, in the 13 months war between Hezbollah and Israel. But Hezbollah remains a major, major paramilitary force. Israeli officials have been surprised that Hezbollah continues to resist, continue to attack both inside Lebanon and attacking military targets and civilian targets in Israel as well. And for your own viewers, Hezbollah is not just a military organization. It's a social and political movement deeply entrenched in Lebanon. So even though that Israel could really degrade Hezbollah's capabilities more and in a greater measure, but Israel cannot really eliminate Hezbollah because it's a social movement, a political movement, and this is the major challenge facing Hezbollah in the next few weeks and next few months and next few years, I would argue. Israel has displaced 1 million Lebanese. This is collective punishment by Israel in order to exert pressure on both the Lebanese government and Hezbollah. And the fact is, this really could become, this massive humanitarian crisis could basically have major impact on state capacity. The Lebanese state could collapse. You might have a huge migration crisis, as, you know, the world witnessed during the Syrian war between 2011 and 2023. So the reality is, the humanitarian crisis in Lebanon, unless Europe and unless the United States and the international community basically intervenes in order to stop Israel's march to all-out war in Lebanon, the humanitarian crisis in Lebanon could become Europe's crisis in a few months or a new year. And the question really is, where is Europe? Why is Europe is not really doing more in order to stop this, you know, humanitarian crisis and Israel's blanket evacuation orders that basically displacing more Lebanese as in the next few weeks and next few months?
France has offered to mediate an end to hostilities. What could that look like, and would they be an appropriate peace broker in this setting?
Well, sadly and tragically, France is the only power that is trying very much to de-escalate. France is the only European power that's really trying to basically urge Israel not to escalate, in particular, all-out ground offensive in Lebanon. Sadly, I mean, you know, Israeli Prime Minister listens to one man, and that's Donald Trump. So Donald Trump has the final word, not President Macron. And it seems that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has a green light from President Trump. And now the attention is on Iran, given the fact that in the past 3 weeks, all-out war, a region-wide conflict. So hardly anyone is paying attention to Lebanon at this particular stage, because Iran is more important given the economic consequences, global economic consequences. So without intervention by the United States, by Trump, I fear that Israeli Prime Minister will use this particular moment to implement the so-called Gaza model in Lebanon and raise villages and create a buffer zone, you know, as it did between 1982 and 2000 in Lebanon.
As far as Georgis, professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at the Lenin School of Economics.
That excerpted analysis was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. That entire interview is available online and recommended. Deutsche Welle is also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, France 24, starting with three press reviews. The first is about the Belgian Prime Minister, who suggested that Europe should normalize relations with Russia to help secure cheaper energy. Then press reactions to Trump suggesting that allies join the U.S. military in the war on Iran. Then The Guardian had an article about a UK representative at the US-Iran talks in Geneva before the US and Israel attacked Iran. The representative said Iran had made concessions on UN nuclear inspections at the talks. Cuba lost all electrical power on Monday and Tuesday this week, just as Trump bragged that he will take the country over. Christopher Sabatini, a senior fellow for Latin America at Chatham House, explains why the power grid failed and some of the effects, which he calls a humanitarian crisis. Christopher talks about Trump's motivations for imposing regime change, including possible tourism casino development, not unlike his Gaza Strip plans. France 24.
Now to the Belgian Prime Minister. He's facing a backlash for suggesting that Europe should normalize relations with Russia to help secure cheaper energy.
Yeah, that's right. He made those comments in the wake of this energy crisis due to the war in Iran. Now, he made those comments on the weekend to L'Echo newspaper, a Belgian daily, calling for the normalization of relations with Moscow to reestablish cheap energy supplies. He called it common sense and said that in private, EU leaders actually agree with him. Politico saying that the Prime Minister's high support, not just in his native Dutch-speaking Flanders region, but also the French-speaking Wallonia part of Belgium, could explain his sort of confidence and willingness in making these very controversial and politically sensitive statements. In any case, Courrier International, a French website here, has sort of compiled all the reactions from the Belgian press in the wake of those comments, and they have been very quick to condemn his comments. This is one such paper here, which reminds us that Bart De Wever, the Prime Minister's five-party coalition, already was in hot water about 6 months ago over the question of recognizing the Palestinian state. The paper says now Belgian diplomacy looks more and more like a Mexican army. That's a French phrase meaning a group of barely organized people. While this Belgian paper here, this columnist here, says that De Wever is seeking a seat at the peace table at the worst time, saying that by extending an olive branch to Moscow now at a time when energy prices are rising really makes Europe look bad and desperate as well.
Start with the U.S. allies refusing to respond to Donald Trump's calls to help secure the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, that's right, Stuart. France, Germany, the U.K., Japan, other allies are refusing to be dragged into the war against Iran at the risk of provoking the ire of Donald Trump. And the Financial Times on its front page here, headlining on allies rejecting a call for warships. The German chancellor, they actually quote the German chancellor just at the bottom of the front page here, as reminding Donald Trump that NATO is a defense alliance, not an intervention one. This after he made threats against NATO in retaliation for allies refusing to help him. As the Financial Times puts it here, it's Donald Trump's coalition of the unwilling U.S. allies have a right not to be sucked into a war they never wanted. The paper says from the Italian press, this is Il Fatto Quotidiano, a paper which here says that essentially accuses Donald Trump of being a pyro of pyromania, saying that he now needs help to extinguish a fire that he himself started. And the independent, the British Daily's independent opinion writer, Sean Grady, meanwhile, reacts to Donald Trump's threats against NATO, as he wryly says here, that Donald Trump has gone from his crybaby phase, where he threw a tantrum if he didn't get his way, to now the surly teenager phase, where he makes dark threats when he doesn't get his way.
One exclusive in The Guardian that Emily wants to point out this morning.
Yeah, particularly interesting article in The Guardian here. As you said, an exclusive discussing Jonathan Powell, the UK's national security advisor. He attended the US-Iran talks in Geneva in late February. Now, most importantly, Powell judged that Tehran's offer during those negotiations had been significant enough to prevent a war in the Middle East. Now, this is important because it's the first time that we know how closely the UK was involved in those negotiations. negotiations, and also because it explains, in part, the UK government's reluctance to back the US attacks on Iran. Now, the UK considered the attack on Iran as unlawful because Powell believed diplomatic channels were still open, especially on the issue of UN inspections of Iran's nuclear sites. Now, the paper says that the British team expected the next round of negotiations to go ahead. Those were scheduled for the 2nd of March in Vienna. Of course, those talks never happened because the US and Israel attacked Iran 2 days before that deadline.
Cuba scrambled this Tuesday to restore power after a nationwide blackout hit the island, just as the US President Donald Trump claimed that he will take it over. Cuba's national electric grid collapsed on Monday, leaving about 10 million people without power amid a U.S.-imposed oil blockade that's crippled the island's already obsolete generation system. Much of Cuba has had power restored this Tuesday, but it was during the nationwide blackout that President Trump of the United States made his menacing remark, telling reporters at the White House, quote, "I do believe I will have the honor of taking Cuba." Well, let's get the analysis and bring in Christopher Sabatini, Senior Research Fellow for Latin America, the U.S. and the Americas program at Chatham House. Christopher, as always, pleasure to have you with us. Why is Cuba's power generation infrastructure in such a poor state? Can you give us some background on that, please?
The first is that they've lost what was effectively originally 100,000 barrels per day of gifted oil from Venezuela, half of which they sold on the global markets, and half of which was for their own consumption. That has disappeared with the oil blockade. But second, they've simply not kept up with technology and updating their electrical grid. So without the combustible, the fuel, and without the sort of the generation capacity and delivery capacity, they're really in dire straits right now in terms of their electricity. And according to Cuba's own authorities, they only have a few weeks to go of fuel left. So it's going to only get worse. And quite frankly, the measures the Trump administration is proposing are not going to provide immediate relief.
So Trump, when he says Cuba's in a bad way, he's quite correct. But Cuba might be in an even worse position because of what Trump has imposed.
Exactly right. He basically imposed this oil blockade, which cut off a lifeline that had been given to Cuba for a long time that kept the lights on, literally, but also was essential for people's cooking oil, people's refrigeration of food. So food is spoiling, and even for the delivery of food, and even for the hard currency that they used to earn when they would sell part of that oil on international markets. This has been a humanitarian crisis, largely of Trump's making.
What is motivating the Trump administration to do this?
Quite frankly, I think part of it is that they want to project their power in the hemisphere, as they did in Venezuela. And I think the Venezuela model is one that Trump thinks he can impose or use in Cuba, as he thinks he's going to use it in Iran. But Cuba is not Venezuela. It's a much more disciplined revolutionary state, one-party state, a command and control economy that's been in power for 67 years now. But, you know, what he wants to do is basically try to root out any governments that are going to be opposed to U.S. interests. We also have to remember that Secretary of State Marco Rubio is a Cuban-American. His parents left Cuba actually before the Fidel Castro revolution. But he has really cut his political teeth, if you will, in South Florida politics, where there are well over 2 million Cuban voters, many of whom are very hardline and are seeking regime change. So Trump is being pushed by, if you will, his own ego, his own plan for the so-called Monroe Doctrine, an adaptation of the Monroe Doctrine, as well as his Secretary of State, who for a long time has had on his agenda of regime change in Cuba.
Donald Trump, no doubt, has something in mind along the lines of what his plan was or his plan is for the Gaza Strip.
For Trump, it was oil in Venezuela. And for Trump, it's now tourism in Cuba. In 1994, he actually sent a number of his scouts to look at opportunities for Trump hotels, casinos in Cuba. So he has his eye on this because, you know, it could become a paradise for Trump's ambitions to create resorts. The problem with that is that tourism is deeply exploitative. Those on the island oftentimes are left out. They often only have service jobs. And the current hotels that are in Cuba that are frequented by foreign tourists, most of them from Europe, most of the staff in these hotels are not Afro-descendant. They're more European descendant. And that's a problem because the bulk of population of Cuba is Afro-descendant. So it really risks creating a very sharp, and racially defined inequality, levels of inequality within Cuba, if it's going to be tourism only that Trump uses to try to build Cuba back.
Christopher Sabatini, as always, thank you very much indeed for being with us. Joining us from Shadow House.
Those press reviews and excerpted interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Also, most podcast sites. I recommend listening to that complete interview online. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, like listeners in Willits, California and Nevada did this week, my PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I'm truly grateful for the donations. They're essential for my weekly production and website fees for this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations around the world. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba was off the air Monday and Tuesday, but had the power up on Wednesday. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel denounced the repeated public threats made by the United States, including plans to seize the country through sanctions and now a fuel blockade. He says Cuba is open to working with American companies as well as Cubans residing in the United States. A European solidarity convoy arrived in Cuba Wednesday night, bringing 5 tons of medical supplies. The 100 members on board included parliamentarians, activists, youth, and trade leaders. They will meet up with a convoy from Miami that's arriving by air, land, and sea on Saturday. The Trump administration approved a $5 billion oil project in the Gulf of Mexico by BP, who created the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel, who is also serving as first secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Cuba, has denounced the repeated public threats made by the United States against the largest island of the Antilles, which include declared plans to forcibly overthrow the constitutional order. In his message, reposted on the Facebook profile of the Communist Party of Cuba, the president of Cuba underscored that Washington is using internal economic difficulties as a pretext, difficulties that it has itself caused and exacerbated over more than 6 decades of aggression and isolation measures. They seek to seize control of the country, of its resources, and of the economy, which they aim to suffocate in order to force our surrender. Díaz-Canel characterized the policy of sanctions as a ferocious economic war being waged against a form of collective punishment against the entire Cuban people. Cuba is open to establishing a fluid commercial relationship with U.S. companies, as well as with Cubans residing in the United States and their descendants, according to Deputy Prime Minister Oscar Perez Oliva. Cuban citizens living abroad, in places such as Miami, will be able to invest in the private sector and own businesses in their country of origin, explained Perez Oliva, who also serves as the Minister of Foreign Trade and Foreign Investment. The initiative extends beyond the commercial sphere, the Deputy Prime Minister stated. It also applies to investments, not only small-scale ones, but also large-scale projects, particularly in infrastructures. Last Friday, during a news conference, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel affirmed that the government is working to expand the participation of Cubans residing abroad in the country's economic and social development. Cuban authorities report the interconnection of several provinces across the Caribbean nation, resorting to electricity service and restoring and prioritizing supply to vital hospitals, water supply centers, and educational institutions. Following the total disconnection of the national power grid, which occurred at noon on Monday, March the 16th, the Ministry of Energy and Mines has announced substantial programs and progress in restoration efforts. In Havana, service restoration is proceeding gradually, as permitted by the Operational Conditions of the National Electric System, the SEN. At 7.06 a.m. local time on Tuesday, the Havana Electrical Company reported that 89 distribution circuits have been restored, benefiting over 200,000 customers, representing approximately 31% of the city. The city now is being restored, and by Wednesday, things have gotten to the point where almost 100% of Havana is back online. The European Solidarity Convoy with Cuba has left by air from Rome with a stopover in Milan, carrying a humanitarian cargo that will be delivered to the island by more than 100 representatives of social and political forces, as well as youth and trade union organizations. A statement released by the initiative's organizers notes that its objective is to support the Cuban people, who are facing a complex situation resulting from the intensification of the criminal blockade, the economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed by the United States for over 60 years. It should be pointed out that the genocidal actions of the U.S. government worsened following the signing on January the 29th by President Donald Trump of an executive order aimed at preventing the delivery of fuel into the island, with the greatest specific goal of attempting to trigger a humanitarian crisis. The senators of the convoy, which include members of the European Parliament and the representatives of parliamentary alliance between the Green Parties of Europe and the Italian Left Parties, alongside leaders of other groups, will transport medicines, medical supplies, and medical equipment to the island. The arrival of the large delegation to the Caribbean is scheduled for today, local time, approximately 10 p.m. Following their arrival, they will engage in various activities between March the 18th and the 21st, at which point they will join the Nuestra America convoy, which is set to arrive in Havana from Miami on that same day. The Trump administration has approved BP, British Petroleum's, proposed $5 billion oil drilling project. Its ultra-drone deep operations off the coast of Louisiana in the Gulf of Mexico, which Trump likes to call the Gulf of America. BP, formerly known as British Petroleum, is the same company responsible for the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster, the oil spill, the largest and worst in U.S. history. Environmentalists warn that the new project also threatens Gulf communities, and it has a sensitive drop area that ecosystems should be following.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcasts. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at 6000. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to work harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. Please consider subscribing. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. In April, the Shortwave Report will be celebrating having been on air for 30 years without a break. For the first 27 years, the show was produced and distributed off the electrical grid using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house connected to a grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.